I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. Two senior Ukrainian officials say a Kyiv delegation that will meet with America's top diplomat in Saudi Arabia will propose a ceasefire with Russia covering the Black Sea and long-range missile strikes. The Ukrainian delegation is due to meet with U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on Tuesday. AP correspondent John Gambrell has more from Dubai.
Ukrainians are trying to recover after that disastrous meeting that President Volodymyr Zelensky had in the Oval Office last month that descended into an argument between him, President Donald Trump, and Vice President J.D. Vance. They're looking to sign, likely in the coming weeks, a rare earths mineral deal that the Trump administration had sought, and the Ukrainians are likely really hoping to turn back on American military aid as well as American intelligence sharing to counter the Russians. For the Americans, they want to push forward with what Trump wants, which is this peace deal, peace talks between him and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Now, so far, Trump has been really conciliatory towards Putin. That's raised the concerns of Europeans who are increasing their defense spending. But Trump in the last couple of days has threatened the Russians with new economic sanctions.
AP correspondent John Gambrell. Military officials from more than 30 nations are expected to take part in Paris talks on the creation of an international security force for Ukraine. A French military official says such an international force would aim to dissuade Russia from launching another offensive after any ceasefire that comes into effect. The long list of participants on Tuesday will also include Asian and Oceania nations joining the talks remotely. This is VOA News. Doctors said Pope Francis is no longer in imminent danger of death as a result of pneumonia, but have decided to keep him hospitalized for several more days to receive treatment. Francis on Monday followed the Vatican's week-long spiritual retreat via video conference. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
As he did on Sunday, Francis participated in the retreat remotely from the Rome hospital where he's being treated. He could see and hear the Reverend Roberto Pasolini, preacher of the papal household, but the priests, bishops and cardinals gathered for the retreat in the Vatican auditorium could not see or hear him. Pasolini is delivering a series of meditations this week on the hope of eternal life, a theme that was chosen well before the Pope's hospitalization on February the 14th with a complex lung infection. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The leader of Canada's most populous province on Monday announced a countermeasure to President Trump's trade war. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
It needs to end.
Premier Doug Ford says Ontario is now charging 25% more for electricity to 1.5 million American homes and businesses in New York, Michigan, and Minnesota. Ford says on CTV it's a necessary step amid what he calls the chaos and confusion of the president's on-again, off-again tariffs.
If the United States escalates, I will not hesitate to shut the electricity off completely.
The president's trade war has incensed Canadians, sent markets sharply lower, and worried American consumers about higher prices. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Fears that uncertainty over trade tariffs will trigger a recession gripped the U.S. stock market on Monday. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
A Reuters poll showed 91% of economists see higher recession risks due to President Trump's shifting trade policies. But the White House pushed back on talk of a recession on Monday. The director of its National Economic Council, Kevin Hassett, said there were many reasons to be optimistic about the U.S. economy, despite concerns about inflation and predictions of a contraction in GDP in the first quarter. He argued U.S. tax cuts would boost the economy and said Trump's tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China were already bringing manufacturing and jobs back to the U.S.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ghanaian President John Dramani meets Burkina Faso's military leader, Captain Ibrahim.
The visit to Burkina Faso is the third in a series of visits to the countries that form the Alliance of Sahel States. The purpose of these visits is to foster healthy relations between Ghana and these three West African states.
Faith leaders and diplomats call for lasting peace in South Sudan. A dam collapses, kills four in Zimbabwe. A British charity calls for closing the gender employment gap for the disabled. Ireland bans Eswatini citizens from traveling to the country without visas.
We wouldn't know precisely why the ban has been effected by the government of Ireland. What we can only do is to respect the decision they have taken as a sovereign state.
And Britain looks to set to hand sovereignty of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama on Monday met with Burkina Faso's military leader, Captain Ibrahim Traore, in Ouagadougou. Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger are three Sahelian countries that have left the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, to form their own bloc, the Alliance of Sahel States. Felix Kwadje Ofosu is Ghana's information minister. He tells me that while President Mahama did not visit Burkina Faso as an emissary of ECOWAS, the Ghanaian president said it was time that the region leaders worked towards restoring confidence in one another.
The visit to Burkina Faso is the third in a series of visits to the countries that form the Alliance of Sahel States. So he has been to Mali on Saturday, Niger yesterday, and Burkina Faso today. The purpose of these visits is to foster healthy relations between Ghana and these three West African states. We all know what has happened between these states and ECOWAS. And as regrettable as it is, there is still the need to maintain a healthy relations, given that they are neighbors with whom we have common interests regarding economic ties and security matters, especially in an area where there is an upsurge in terrorist activity in the region. It is important that relations are maintained with these countries on the issues that matter.
I have spoken with some ECOWAS officials, and when you speak with them, it is not exactly clear what they want from these three Sahel countries. Did President Mahama take any particular message? For example, does ECOWAS want these three countries back into the fold of the ECOWAS community?
Well, President Mahama has made it clear, and it came up during the discussion, that he is not acting as a mediator between ECOWAS and these countries. At best, you can describe him as a bridge that enables channels of communications to remain open between these countries and ECOWAS, but he is not seeking to mediate between the two bodies. It is important, however, to appreciate the issues that informed the breakaway, because knowing exactly what their perspective is on these matters will help mold the kind of relationship that needs to exist between individual countries and these three states.
So when President Mahama says, he's quoted as saying that he gained fresh insight into the concerns of Burkina Faso and its regional allies regarding the relationship with ECOWAS, can you shed light on what the fresh insights are?
Well, as you may be aware, at the time that the breakaway happened, President Mahama was an opposition leader. So in that position, he had limited information on what may have triggered the breakaway of these countries. Now that he is president, and given that he is a respected statesman in the West African sub-region, it was necessary to find out what the real issues are. So it is in that regard that President Mahama has sought to find out exactly what the matters are and what the concerns of these states are.
What is the level of economic and cultural relations between Burkina Faso and Ghana? Is there any?
Well, Burkina Faso is our immediate northern neighbor. And it might interest you to note that we share cultural and even ethnic ties. There are people who live across the border who are separated by artificial lines, but in actual fact are relatives. And they transit to either side of the border in their daily lives. And if that is the case, it is extremely important that these ties remain strong and healthy. There are also important economic relationships regarding trade. As you see, Ghana supplies Burkina Faso and its other neighbors electricity. And these ties are important to both economies. Burkina Faso, as you may know, is a landlocked country. And therefore, they rely on Ghanaian ports for the importation and exportation of goods and services. And that is why, as part of the visit, President Obama has sought to highlight the important economic ties that we share and the need to ensure that they remain healthy.
Felix Kwadje Ofosu is Ghana's information minister. He was speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. A spokesperson says Eswatini will engage the government of Ireland to learn the reasons for the banning of visa-free travel by Emaswati to Ireland. The online Swaziland News report that Ireland has banned Emaswati from traveling to the country without visas amid alleged fraudulent immigration to the country. The paper said the process was hijacked by a syndicate collecting as much as $2,500 to facilitate travel there. Eswatini government spokesperson Alfios Zumalo tells me that Ireland has not provided Eswatini a specific reason or reasons for the visa-free travel ban.
Well, we wouldn't know precisely as to why the ban has been effected by the government of Ireland. What we can only do is to respect the decision they have taken as a sovereign state and, of course, encourage our people to comply with whatsoever requirements that have been put in place when Liswati is requiring to travel to Ireland in terms of how to obtain a proper visa. We have not been taught specifically as to what are the reasons that have compelled the government of Ireland to put in place this kind of measure.
Is it true that the process has been abused through fraudulent means or illegal immigration?
That can only be left to speculation because they did not mention or give the reasons as to why the government have taken the decision to put those measures in place. But you can look around the world, there are other countries that are protecting their sovereignty and their states, that are tightening immigration rules and laws, which was first and foremost spearheaded by your own country through the first presidential presidency of Donald Trump, and he has taken it to another level this time around in his coming back to office. This is the best way probably to save their national interests. And what we can do under the circumstances is to advise our citizens to ensure that there is compliance in terms of obtaining visa when you intend to travel to Ireland.
How did the visa-free travel to Ireland come about between Ireland and Eswatini? How did that come about?
Well, we don't know. There was never any engagement at any stage. We only received a communication to that effect through our foreign ministry, which received it from the foreign minister of Ireland to alert and inform us of these changes.
I guess my question was, how did it come about that Emaswati can go to Ireland visa-free?
Well, I wouldn't know, but I think prior to this decision, there weren't probably much Emaswati that were traveling to Ireland. And I would want to think and believe under these circumstances that probably they have noticed increased numbers of Emaswati that are traveling to their country and for reasons best known to them have somehow decided to regulate the inflow of coming of Emaswati to their respective country.
So your government doesn't know whether the process has been abused?
Well, we wouldn't know if the process has been abused because if it was abused at some point by our citizens, I'm sure that the government of Ireland would have communicated that loud and clear to our government and there could have been some engagement prior to this decision.
Are you going to look into the suggestion that perhaps there was a syndicate that was collecting money from people?
We are definitely going to look into that. But the syndicate that is being alluded to here has not yet been formally conveyed to our government as the decision that have motivated the reasons for this regulation.
Alfios Zumalo is the Eswatini government spokesperson. He was speaking with me from the Eswatini capital, Mbabane. You are listening to the Africa of America. I'm James Barté in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 11. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. South Sudan's fragile peace is once again under threat as renewed fighting erupts in parts of Upper Nile, Western Equatoria, and Western Barigaza states. As tensions rise, faith-based institutions, diplomats, and regional bodies are urging political leaders to uphold the revitalized peace agreement and work towards dialogue rather than violence. Sheila Pony reports from Juba on the growing concerns.
As violence escalates, church leaders, including Reverend Arama Justin, chair of the South Sudan Council of Churches and primate of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, says the biggest threat to peace in South Sudan is not just the presence of armed groups, but the deep-rooted lack of trust among communities, politicians, and security forces.
The biggest threat to peace in South Sudan is lack of trust among South Sudanese. People of South Sudan, they don't trust themselves. Political leaders don't trust themselves. And the civilians don't trust the organized forces. So the organized forces also don't trust the civilians. And then the availability of arms in the hands of civilians, armed groups, and then different army. That is also another threat to peace.
Faith-based institutions have long played a role in South Sudan's peace efforts, but they say lessons from past conflicts have shown that peace is a slow process. Regional bodies such as the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, known as IGAD, the African Union, and the United Nations have expressed deep concern over the ongoing violence. Speaking after a high-level meeting, IGAD Special Envoy to South Sudan, Ismail Wise, emphasized the need for political leaders to take urgent action.
And we would like that the leaders of this country to sit together and take this country out of the crisis and assure the people of the Republic of South Sudan that they have the right for peace, that they have right, like any other nation in the region, also to live in dignity and without fear of any damage to their health.
The government insists the security situation is under control. Minister of Presidential Affairs Chol Maiwud Ajong reaffirmed President Salva Kiir's commitment to lasting peace.
President is asking, the president has been a report. He has been saying this, that he is not willing and he will not be able. He decided that he should not take the people of South Sudan back to war again. He has been on record saying that. That has been his consistent message. Mission for this, and we go back to the pause of the implementation of the 2018 agreement.
For many South Sudanese, the current insecurity has left them disillusioned. Deng Kun, a resident of Akobo County of Jonglei State in South Sudan, who has lived through decades of war, shared his frustrations over the unrelenting violence.
Everyone is desperate in this country. It has been lost the hope in the country. Have you seen somewhere like the people who have run away from in the refugee camp, they are facing a lot of challenges because of this insecurity. Because if there's any good security in the country, no one should be outside. All of us should be here. Then everybody run out for daily business. Then they will care for his kid, whatever it is to.
As South Sudan struggles with recurring violence, religious leaders and civil society groups continue to call for dialogue and reconciliation, urging all parties to prioritize peace for the future of the country. For VOA News, I am Sheila Aponi.
A British charity for the disabled, citing World Bank data, says the world could gain trillions annually in gross domestic product, or GDP, if women were employed at the same rate as men. The World Bank says the failure to close gender employment gaps reduces a country's GDP by 20% on average. Experts are calling for greater efforts to improve women's access to jobs, especially for women with disabilities. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
In many countries, women face multiple challenges when seeking employment, starting a business, or doing anything that will economically sustain their lives and those of their families. According to Sight Savers International, a British non-governmental agency that aims to prevent avoidable blindness and ensure equality for the visually impaired, global GDP would increase from $106 trillion to $127 trillion if women were employed at the same rate as men. Overall, the World Bank data indicates that failure to employ more women reduces a country's economic growth by 20% on average. 41-year-old Michelle Madao from Zimbabwe is a beautician living with osteogenesis imperfecta, a brittle bone disease. Despite her disorder, she attempts to help people like her who need to learn how to run a business.
I'm mentoring upcoming beauticians who are disabled, speaking to them, helping them build up their own businesses. Whatever line of business that I am familiar with, I'm always there to assist them because I also want to see them win, just like I'm winning right now.
Lydia Rosasi, 29, works at the office of the Kenyan government spokesperson, where she leads inclusive communications. Rosasi works every day to ensure that people living with blindness, deafness, and other disabilities are not left behind when the government communicates with its citizens. She says she bettered herself to stand out in the job market.
For me, one of the greatest pillars in terms of navigating this double bias has been education and skills development. In 2021, I joined the IT Bridge Academy, and you know, at that time, the digital skills were gaining a lot of prominence in the job market. So it gave me confidence and the capability that opened my doors.
Many African women struggle to get jobs, either because they were married off or became mothers at a young age, leaving them unable to finish their studies. Others encounter discrimination or sexual violence in their workplaces. Experts say empowering girls with education and allowing them to finish school is one way to reduce the gender employment gap. Liana Jones works on economic empowerment at Sight Savers. She says closing the gender gap requires policy reforms and cultural change.
In terms of closing the gender gap in employment and entrepreneurship, this really requires coordinated interventions at multiple levels. At the policy level, we need to eliminate discriminatory laws and regulations that restrict women's economic participation. For women with disabilities, we need specialised approaches that address both gender and disability-related barriers simultaneously. And lastly, we need to challenge social norms through engagement with community leaders, men and boys.
According to Equal Measures 2030, a coalition of national, regional and global leaders from feminist networks, civil society and international development, in at least 77 countries, women are not allowed to work in the same jobs or sectors as men. In Africa, only 5 countries have a full set of laws mandating workplace equality for women. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Residents of Chipinge in eastern Zimbabwe are surveying their losses a day after a dam burst in the area, causing at least 4 deaths. As Kuza Navashi reports from Harare, several people are still missing.
The Chipinge Dam collapsed suddenly on Sunday in Zimbabwe. Pearson Sithole, a councillor in Ward 10 of the Chipinge East constituency, says the large amount of water washed away livestock and property in a number of villages on Sunday.
Animals were washed away, some houses were washed away, some grinding mills were washed away, a lot of property was damaged because of this scenario.
Sithole says at least 4 people were killed and more than 20 livestock have died.
Yesterday we had a dam burst in Ward 7, which is a ward above my Ward 10. There was a lot of water coming from that dam down the Mwara River. It washed away 2 female kids. Going down the river, they washed away 5 young people. The eldest aged 13. So out of 7 people went missing yesterday, 4 are discovered so far. But we're still looking for 3 remaining.
John Missy, the Manicaland acting director for local government services, says 3 people are still missing. He said one of those who died was a child who was accompanying their mother while she was washing clothes in the river. He says the government is doing all it can to assist the families of those who died in the flooding.
We are yet to get more updates whether we have got other casualties that have happened, because as you know, it's a river system. We don't know what has happened downstream.
Missy says they are relying on community members to report their missing loved ones as search and rescue efforts continue. Missy says they are yet to get a technical report on what caused the dam to breach. Sithole estimates the affected area to be a 30-kilometer radius. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe in Harare.
The Chagos Islands are one of the last vestiges of the British Empire. They are currently home to a key U.S. military base. But under pressure from the United Nations, the U.K. looks set to hand sovereignty of the islands to Mauritius. Critics say the deal would compromise the security of the region in the face of a growing threat from China, as Henry Richwell reports from London.
The Chagos Islands, about 2,500 kilometres east of Madagascar, have been a British colony since 1814. They've been administered from Mauritius, which argues it was illegally forced to give them away in return for its own independence in 1968. Britain forcibly expelled the Chagos Islands population in the 1960s and 70s to make way for a US military base on Diego Garcia, one of the largest islands in the archipelago. In 2019, the International Court of Justice said Britain should cede control of the islands to Mauritius. Now, London is seeking to finalise such a deal. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer told lawmakers last month it was vital to secure the future of the US base.
Without legal certainty, the base cannot operate in practical terms as it should. That is bad for our national security, and it's a gift to our adversaries.
It's reported that Britain will cede sovereignty of the Chagos Islands and pay Mauritius around $116 million a year for 99 years to lease back Diego Garcia and allow the military base to remain. US President Donald Trump said last month that he was inclined to approve the deal. It also has the backing of India, which has close ties to Mauritius. But there are security concerns. Britain's Conservative Opposition Party has described the proposed plan as a strategic disaster for Britain. China has a burgeoning economic relationship with Mauritius. Some fear those ties could compromise the US base on Diego Garcia. Evan Fowler is from the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China, which focuses on threats from Beijing.
Mauritius owes China quite a lot. It uses that to seek sort of political advantage. That area is strategically important to us, and the Chinese understand this too. The Chinese have already been active militarily around the Chagos Islands.
After their expulsion, many Chagosians settled in Mauritius. Thousands also left for Britain. Frankie Bontom and Maxwell Evanor are with the advocacy group Chagossian Voices. They argue Mauritius has never had a rightful claim to their homeland and object to Britain's proposed deal to cede sovereignty.
Once again, we are ignored. People are discussing the future of our homeland without us. We feel like history repeating itself.
We now find ourselves our very own identity, our very own self, being given to someone else by made of policy without asking us. We are still colonized. We are the lost colony of Africa.
Under the terms of the deal, Chagossians and their families would be able to return to the outer islands in the archipelago, but not to Diego Garcia, which would remain off limits. The Chagossians are eager to return home, but they appear powerless as geopolitical forces shape negotiations over the future of the islands. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And that's it for this Tuesday, February 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying thank you for listening.
Thank you.